kia ora, I'm Madison Reedy. Welcome to Life in the Fast Lane. New Zealand businesses are a resilient bunch. They've weathered numerous crises, the GFC, earthquakes, and now COVID-19. For the past 20 years, the Deloitte Fast 50 has championed those business owners who've not only survived, but thrived, honouring businesses that have achieved often unbelievable annual revenue growth. So what's their secret to success? In this podcast, I'll be asking some of the country's most notable entrepreneurs how they did it and what to do when the going gets tough. This is Life in the Fast Lane. Well, she's no stranger to starting a company. Naomi Ballantyne is said to be the first woman in the world to set up not one, but two successful insurance businesses. She was a founding employee of Sovereign and went on to establish Club Life, now known as Cigna. After that, she set up the company that she still leads today, Partners Life, transforming it from a small startup in 2011 to now being one of the country's leading insurance firms. Naomi is a true champion for life and health insurance, being awarded the New Zealand Order of Merit for her services to the industry. She also hasn't hid from the fact that it's a tough place to be right now, as insurers face more scrutiny than ever before. Naomi, welcome to Life in the Fast Lane.
Thanks so much, Madison.
So you've spent 30 years in the insurance industry. Is it really as exciting as you make it seem?
38 years, and it still fills me with excitement and passion when I get up in the morning. So yes, it still excites me exactly like it always has.
What is it that's so exciting?
It's really interesting. When you're an entrepreneur and a founder of a business, I guess your legacy is slightly different than maybe it is for people who are employed in established firms. To get to the end of your life and have been able to be who you want to be and run a business based on your own values and principles, as opposed to run a business within a set framework that's already been set for you. So the thing that really excites me is we do good things for people, and I get to run the business to make sure that we set a standard for the rest of the industry in terms of what good looks like.
Do you have an example, a recent example of something that gave you that gratification of somebody's life you changed?
It's really interesting because people know me as the face of the company or the voice of the company. Customers kind of talk to me in a way that they wouldn't necessarily approach companies that they think are large establishments. So even though we're large, I still get customers who ring me personally and cry on the phone when they tell me that what a difference not only the product, but also the way in which we dealt with them through, you know, what's always a crisis, because it's life and health interruption that we deal with. And they're just so desperately grateful and thankful. And when you think about it, I'm just really doing my job. But it is those moments that really, truly make you realise you're making a difference in this world.
Let's talk about these numbers. Partners Life placed 7th on the Fast 50 Index in 2014, with annual growth of 762%. Did you set out to grow your second company with that astonishing rate of growth, or did it happen naturally?
No. No, we didn't expect that rate of growth. What we did do, though, is totally focus on if we deliver what is the best outcome for the customer, then the advisors who sell the product, customers who buy the product almost don't have any choice but to buy you. And if we stick with that and we do that consistently, we will get growth. We just never expected that the growth would come as quickly as it did.
And the model was quite different, wasn't it, with advisors? Can you talk me through that and how that was possibly a driver for your growth?
It was a driver for our growth, but it's also very scary because you have no control of your own distribution when you choose to deal with independent advisors who have choice. But we totally passionately believe that's the right thing for an advisor to bring to their customer, the ability to choose the right product provider and to influence the behaviour of those product providers because of that leverage. And so we deliberately chose to only sell through independent advisors because we thought it was the right thing to do for the customer. And then we had to make ourselves attractive enough to those advisors for them to recommend a brand new business to their customers. We had to be so much better than everyone else to do so. But that in itself is an endorsement and a recommendation and a marketing strategy, which has delivered us to where we are today.
Was that quite controversial at the time, that different model?
We actually started it with Sovereign. We also followed the same pathway with Club Life, but not so much with a focus on understanding that if you tick all the boxes for the customer, you almost take choice away from the advisor. And so by focusing totally on being the best in every sense from day one. As an independent advisor, we really took away their choice, which we hadn't hit the mark of in the other two companies.
A working formula, that's for sure.
Yeah.
How unusual is it for a financial services firm to witness that level of growth?
It's just totally unheard of. And it brings challenges because you have to run really fast to keep up with yourself. Because once the business starts coming, you can't turn it off. So the biggest challenge once we started to get that growth was figuring out how we were going to handle it and grow our infrastructure fast enough to cope with it without falling over.
I am very keen to talk with you more about that. But first, let's talk a bit more about resilience. Being a woman in the financial services, particularly insurance industry, I can't imagine that was always smooth sailing.
When I started in the life insurance industry, it was a very, very old boys club. And a lot of older men sitting around boardroom tables guffawing about how, you know, how much they knew and how little everyone else knew. I took a lot of personal insults because I'm not a very girly girl, and in those days women were meant to wear suits and lots of makeup and jewellery and just look a certain way. And I just didn't.
What sort of things did people say to you, if you don't mind sharing?
You're quite talented, but you never look quite the part. I was called dear a lot by men probably younger than me. Sitting in boardrooms where you're at the table because you're a director, could you just get us all a cup of tea? You know, that kind of headset, which you either give in to or you don't. And clearly I didn't.
Good on you. Is it still a challenge?
Less so now. And I like to think I've been part of paving the way. So there's a lot more senior women executives in our industry today, and I'm just delighted to see that. It's a lot more balance in boardrooms and at executive levels, which I think actually makes for a much better industry and a much clearer career path for young women coming into the industry today. But I certainly still get attacked, and people who don't like to compete with you try to discredit you in whatever way they can. And I've learned a long time ago that the more they're talking about me and the more I'm talking about me, the more people are talking about me, right? So it doesn't stick.
How do you not let that get in your way and get in your mind?
It's interesting because I had a very hard father, total expectations of always winning at everything and never being quite good enough. And when you're very young, you either buckle into that. Or I was fortunate, I guess, that I was bright enough to go, well, you're telling me all those things and yet I'm winning all these awards and, you know, and achieving all this. It can't be right. And the reason I'm telling you that story is because when you get older, if your father hasn't destroyed you with you're never good enough, then it doesn't matter what other people say. You have to learn to go, logic tells me that you're not right, or I know my heart and what you're saying about me is not who I know I am. So therefore, your opinion does nothing to me. And it's been the biggest driver of the reason for me being able to take the risks and put myself out there and take a chance on the things that I do.
Do you think that resilience like yours can be learned, or is it all intuitive?
I think it can be learned, and I hope that I can teach it and have been able to teach it. So I run character courses for RYLA, Rotary Youth Leaders Association, to try and pass on those things that I learned the hard way. So it's not a theoretical course. It's here's what I had to learn, and here's what you get out of it, and here's how you can practice, and here's how you can change some of the behaviours that have been ingrained into you. It's particularly important for Pacific Island youth, so I am from a Pacific Island background, and there's a lot of cultural don't speak out, you know, all of those kinds of things, and being able to challenge that, because the only person you pay for that is you.
What is your best tip then for being resilient in the face of adversity?
I think it is totally understanding that even if you can't see the pathway, probably no one else can either. And in the trying to figure something out, you often find a different pathway than you thought. Most successful entrepreneurs have stood at those crossroads a billion times and not known what to do, but they just take a step. And knowing that gives you that belief that if you just take a step and then another step and then another step, you will find a way. It might not be the one you thought, it might not be the one you wanted, but you might find yourself landing in a completely different and better place if you do. And I think if you take that fear away and go, you can't break it by taking a step. You don't, there is no right answer, so an answer is okay. And the more you do it, the more confidence you get.
Incredible advice. Let's talk about business growth. What did you learn about business growth when starting your first business and then ultimately do differently with the second?
In our first business, we truly did focus on innovation. So we could see that there were products that were missing, and we thought, well, we'll invent them. And we found very quickly that independent advisors who can offer choice don't want different at the time, because it was too hard to learn it when they also had to know six other different companies' product. And so it took us an awful long time of repeating the messages over and over and over again to get advisors to really buy into some of those amazing innovations, which, by the way, are now just standard. So what we learned is, to get started, you have to give people what they know, and then you can introduce new as they get going and they trust you. But as long as you've got what they know as a basic toolbox to start with, and then for us to know we were doing the right thing for customers, just make them better than the rest of the market, then that was how we got the growth that we got this time round rather than first time round. Interestingly, you would have thought it would have been the other way around, but it wasn't. So we innovate now all the time, but we've got the basic toolbox that gives people the comfort to come with us and then to learn with us in terms of what we offer for their customers. So that was a huge learning curve.
So the best way, I guess, then, isn't to be bullish and go to the market and say, this is what you need and it is better. That doesn't work.
Not when you're dealing with intermediaries, advocates on behalf of the customer who you don't control. So if you want to get early growth, then what we needed to do with an intermediated distribution channel was give them something they weren't scared of in terms of being able to tell their customers about it.
Once you did get that ball rolling with the advisors and you saw such extreme growth, did you have any speed wobbles with that?
Absolutely, we had speed wobbles. So we did a really good job of keeping up with the pace of the business that we were processing. So we were getting accolades about service and how well our people were responding. We had invested a huge amount of money in modern systems, well beyond our means, effectively, as a startup business normally would. But we knew that that was going to be a key component to how quickly we could cope with the growth. So that was a good tick. But we sold a medical product, and we assumed that we would sell a little bit of this medical product. It's not reinsured. There's no financial support for the commissions that you pay for that product. So we estimated that we would sell about $1 million of that in the first year, and it would cost us this much in capital. And in the first year, we sold about 5 times as much as we expected to. And because that product didn't have any capital support coming in, it was directly out of shareholder capital. So after about 15 months, we had to stop paying upfront commissions on the medical because we just couldn't afford it, and rechange our conversation with our advisors about why getting commission in a different way on that product was a good thing for them. And we lost about 20% of our new business run rate for the next 12 months. But ultimately, we got them there, and it came back with a hiss and a roar. And, you know, growth took off again from then. But making that call to, we knew we would lose business. We knew our competitors who were still offering upfront commissions would attack us. We'd gain back some of that business. But we had to do it, or we would have run out of money, which you can't do as a life insurance company. So that was a really scary time. And that came from just growing way faster than we could have anticipated. So that was a lesson to say, you can slow it down, and you can turn it off, and you can recover, which is not something I would have thought previous to that.
And that turning it off actually can be in its best interest sometimes.
Yes, absolutely. Much stronger company as a result of doing that.
Is growth for the sake of growth enough, or do you think that an entrepreneur needs to have another goal in sight to focus on?
Yeah, and I think that that's where that legacy piece comes in, that you're not building a business for how much you can make out of it today. That's not why anyone really starts a business, and certainly not a business like life insurance, which you are making very long-term promises to the customers that come on board. So that legacy of building something that is sustainable and goes on well past you is a really important component of what drives me to get out of bed. So you have to make sure that what you're building is sustainable, that your shareholders and future shareholders will want to invest in the business, that your staff will want to work for you and try hard for you and come with you when it's scary, like in the middle of COVID, and that your advisors see their business success intrinsically linked with yours over the long term. If you do all of those things, then you build a sustainable business. And it might not look like it does when I'm no longer running it, but, you know, Sovereign, where I was a founder, is now IAA, but it's the largest company in New Zealand, and Cigna is a significant player. I built, and they are successful still. And not necessarily because of me now, but they wouldn't have started without me. And that's a huge peace of mind for what was the point of me.
At the very beginning, though, when you're starting any of those companies that you just mentioned, what are the sort of questions that you have to ask yourself to tell yourself that your business is sustainable?
Yeah, why would anyone invest in me? How can I convince them that I'm a safe place for their money and I can achieve these things? Why would our customer buy this? They need to want it, understand it, and be willing to pay for it. Otherwise, you don't have a business. Then how do you get that message out to customers, particularly in our space, because people don't want to know about our products until they need them, right? They don't want to think they need them. So how do you get that education and message out to them? And then how do you make profit from this business so that you can do it over and over and over and over again? And unless you can answer all of those questions, you can't run a business. A lot of people go into business because they've got a passion for the product, or they think it's a really good idea, or because Nana did it, or someone down the road did it, and they think in terms of what they will achieve in the next 3 to 5 years, and then I'll flick that business on. But they don't really think about, why would anyone want to buy it?
Do you think that too few entrepreneurs ask themselves that question?
Yeah, I think they do. And often because people fall into entrepreneurship because they've lost a job, or they don't want to work for someone else, you know, and all those things are true. You can get pleasure from that. But ultimately, unless you're building something that you know is needed, it won't work in the long term, and it won't have any value at the end.
That's quite confronting, though, looking in the mirror, is it not?
It's really confronting. And one thing that people don't know is I've invested every single cent of my wealth each time I've started a business. So they think I'm rich, and on paper I am, but actually I still have a mortgage, because everything I put into the business to get it up and running and going, and to convince other people that I was willing to take a risk on the business alongside them, not just give me your money and I'll turn it into something and I won't take any risk, right? So there is risk in reward. I am not lucky, yeah, which is what a lot of people say, and I just nod because I think, yep, you just keep telling me I'm lucky, and so you don't do anything. You don't do any of the things that it takes to get here, and it takes bravery.
Let's talk more about the life insurance industry. It's a really personal topic, so how do you cope with that day in, day out?
Well, people die. I learned that a long time ago, whether we talk about it or not, and people get sick, whether they have insurance for it or not. And so one of the frustrations I have is we don't talk about it. Why don't we talk about death and money? Parents don't, schools don't, you know, it's like this taboo subject. It's like you're wishing it on somebody if you talk about it, which is ridiculous, because it happens and we need to be prepared for it.
So why do you bother getting up every day trying to convince New Zealanders who are notoriously underinsured or not insured at all that it actually matters?
For exactly that reason. Because there are so many people that are vulnerable. And you just have to look at Give A Little, where people who never thought it was going to happen to them, who could have afforded the insurance premium but can't afford the Keytruda or the cost of sending someone overseas for some kind of treatment, and they're at the mercy of their friends. That's why. Because if I get the right message across, and if I can educate people and get them talking about money and death and disability, then that won't be them. That they won't be in that space, and that the government support benefits can be used for people who can't take care of themselves rather than as a backup for people who should take care of themselves. So it's like a puzzle, and I haven't fixed it yet. So there is more to do.
The insurance industry is flooded with big international players. How do you and your business compete with competitors who are essentially cashed up to their eyeballs?
I think it's a different incentive again. If you're building a legacy and you want to do the right thing by people and you want to build a sustainable business long after you have gone, then you do different things than if you're trying to deliver shareholder return, which is often what drives large international businesses. When they have a piece of New Zealand or a piece in Australia, they are required to deliver a return on equity. And I think that that can put huge pressure on the people within those businesses to behave in ways towards their customers they may not think is right, but it is what gives you that short-term gain. And we've got investors in our business as well, but we are very fortunate, and maybe it's not fortunate, maybe it's more to do with design, that they are focused on the overall growth of the business, not the immediate shareholder return.
When you talk about the design of investors, how is yours different to possibly another insurance firm?
We have private equity. So a lot of our advisors, a lot of our staff are founder shareholders, and we have PE firms. And we've got New Zealand PE firms that are solely based on New Zealand firms, and Blackstone, which is a large international PE firm. We've got small investment companies. We've got larger ones. We've got a really good mix around the table, but they're attracted about the long-term growth prospects of this business. As a startup life insurance company, you've got a long runway to go ahead of you and the opportunity to really change the shape of the industry and become the benchmark for it, which makes you attractive, by the way, to future investors, but also as a trade sale opportunity in the future or whatever. So for them, us doing it the right way is also driving them towards their goal. But you need to have patient investors, right? That's the key, because you're not going to get there overnight. It takes time to build to the scale that will kind of deliver those things. So choosing the right investment parties who are looking for the right type of investment is important, not just somebody's got capital for me, so I'll take it, because that can be a really big sort of noose around your neck.
That Blackstone deal was really, really big at the time.
Yes.
What was the bottom line that you had when signing an investment deal like that?
It's really scary, right? Because we're sitting opposite a huge, enormous global company with huge amounts of money that has a million other choices. You're in a negotiation, which you need to protect your business in terms of your vision for how you see the business growing ahead. And you need to protect the shareholders that have been with you since day one in that deal. So you have to have a bottom line, which is, what is the price that you're willing to go to, and how much control are you willing to succeed to them, and how much do you need them to commit to the story before you say yes to this deal? So knowing that in the end they want you rather than you want them is a key to being able to make that call. But it is an incredibly scary place to be.
You mentioned picking patient investors. Does such a thing really exist? And how do you test their patience before you sign a deal with
them? Well, it's patience in different ways. So we're a rapid growth story. So they don't have to be patient to get growth. Yeah, but they have to be patient to exit, because you need to be in a point where you're delivering cash flows for dividends in order to list, for example, right? Rather than just sucking in capital to grow. So they need to understand that horizon and buy into that. They're gaining. They're not patiently waiting for any kind of value, but understanding what it is, the value proposition that you're offering. And in our case, it was that growth over the next sort of 5 years after they came into the business. Before then, we have options about how else we can go to the market and replace their capital. So it's truly understanding what you bring to the table and making sure they understand that that's what they're buying into.
You recently released a report that you had to provide to regulators that showed you don't pay 9% of claims, you receive hundreds of complaints, and that you've increased premiums on some policies. Why would you choose to air your dirty laundry for everyone to see?
Yeah, well, see, I don't see it as dirty laundry. So not paying claims you shouldn't pay is actually good for all the customers you should pay and who are paying you premium. So the reason 9% of claims don't get paid, some of them the client withdraws. We sell medical insurance, right? So they get a pre-approval for a claim and then they don't proceed with the procedure, for example. So we count that. We count it as a claim and as a claim not paid. There are claims where a customer's just not covered for what they want to claim against. And it's funny how people always want what they didn't buy when they need it, yeah. But, you know, people who didn't buy disability insurance, they bought trauma cover and then they break their leg and they want someone to, you know, pay them a monthly benefit. They're just not covered for it. People who don't meet the definition, so they go to claim against a total and permanent disability policy and there's no medical profession saying it's permanent. And then you get right down to non-disclosure, where people have cover because they didn't disclose all of their health issues at application, and had they, you wouldn't have covered them. So you're not going to pay them that claim because that's not fair on all the people who do tell you the truth. So there's good reason for us not to pay claim, and being able to put that out in the marketplace and say, you don't want us to pay these claims, because otherwise your premium will go up in order for us to pay these claims. So being able to put it out there means you can have a conversation about it that educates people so they don't think all insurance companies are terrible, and they go, yeah, I don't want you to pay. I don't want you to pay for insurance fraud with my premium.
How important is transparency to you?
It's really important. We're the good guys. So if we can't go, and here's how we know, and when we get it wrong, here's what we got wrong and what we did about it, then why would anyone trust us other than we're saying we're the good guys? So this transparency work that we're doing is about going, hey, if we're willing to tell the regulators what we do, then why aren't we telling our customers and consumers and advisors, so they can go, this company, we know warts and all. What are other people doing? They're just potentially telling us they're the good guy. So we think it gives us credibility and it holds us to account to fix the things that we find or others find broken, and then to tell people about it, which we think will build trust over time. And it's that longevity and sustainability of your business that's important to us.
Does being so transparent, though, make your business more vulnerable or more resilient?
There is a risk that it is easy to throw stones at and change the conversation around, hey, we pay 97% of our claims. I've heard people say that. But if they're carving out all of those types of claims and not calling them claims, then we would be at that level as well. So there is risk to us in that. There is risk to us in people saying, look, they've put up premiums in that year and not go back to the previous years where actually we reduced premiums, for example. But we fundamentally believe that we should be able to answer those questions. And if we can't, then customers shouldn't trust us.
Very important for such an industry like insurance, isn't it?
We are asking people to trust us that sometime long into the future, if anything bad happens to you, we will be there.
Can you cast your mind back to last year and the conduct and culture review by the Reserve Bank and the Financial Markets Authority, specifically when they were looking at life insurers? What was it like to be under that scrutiny spotlight?
It wasn't the scrutiny that was our concern, because this information that we have been able to provide, we've always been able to provide. It's just we didn't have a who to give it to. And that's being new and not having legacy systems and years of having purchased other companies and then not knowing anything about the book that you bought. So we have some advantages, deliberate strategy. So the actual investigation wasn't the problem. It was the rhetoric in the media about why it was needed. So there's the Australian Royal Commission, all these terrible things are happening in Australian banks, etc. So therefore, we think New Zealand companies must all be bad. And there was a lot of rhetoric in the media from regulators and ministers about all commissions are bad, all advisors are bad, all insurance companies are bad, lumping insurance together and talking about fire and general policies and life companies being lumped in, and we're completely different types of contracts. Ours are permanent, can't change them every year. You know, they're quite different, and there was no ability to counter that kind of voice because it was for a reason. There was a political purpose to deliver those messages and no ability to counter that. So actually, the outcome of the conduct and culture review and being able to say, here it is, helps to balance that kind of rhetoric. It was really damaging. And they didn't find anything systemic in New Zealand, which didn't surprise me. But they certainly did a lot of damage before they got to that point in terms of feeding people's, yeah, I knew you can't trust them, see it's a waste of money, no one ever pays claims kind of headset, that stops people from buying these products. We just made it 10 times worse for a period of time. It's settled now. I think that there's a much more balanced conversation now, but that was very difficult at the time.
What sort of leadership did you feel like you had to provide to your staff then while all of that damage was being done to your company?
Total transparency. Exactly the same thing as we're doing with our customers. Here's what they're saying. Here's what we've done. Here's all of the information. You can access it at any time. Ask any questions. Here's what we got wrong. Here's how we've got to fix it. Can you help us to fix this? Can you find anything else that you think that we've got wrong that we should be looking at? So total openness and transparency. That was the only way to lead through that. It's not a secret. We're not hiding anything. And you're part of us.
How about COVID? I mean, that hasn't been easy for any business, but what impact has that had on Partners Life?
It's had positive and negative impacts. So from a business point of view, we had an almost immediate stop to half of our new business because half the advisors didn't know how to find clients or communicate with them or give them advice without that face-to-face setting, because they were totally convinced that the only way to get people to trust you is face-to-face. The other half carried on, but that's half your business overnight. And so then you've got staff who are terrified because they're hearing all these stories about unemployment rates. So the most important thing for us was to calm them all down and convince them you're okay, you're all safe, we're going to do everything we can to hold on to every job that we can through this process. That might mean no salary increases and no bonuses, and we have to cut our expenses, but you're going to be okay. We then immediately went to customers are out of work, they've lost money. So we can either go, oh, well, sad, but by policy, or we can do something to help them at least for as long as we can still be customers at the end of this and be covered for anything that happens to them while they're going through that. So we did something close to 5,000 premium holidays for customers where we waived up to 6 months premiums and kept them covered. So not suspended their cover, and we paid out over $1 million in claims on those policies while we weren't receiving any premiums for them. About 90% of those customers are back paying premiums to us and are so thankful. But that's a big scary decision to take when you don't know how much that's going to cost you, because that's premiums we haven't had and all the expenses we've still had, including claims and all of the costs associated with that. But your heart and your head tell you it's the right thing to do. And the management team and the board just went, no one knows if it's the right thing to do or not, but emotionally it's the right thing to do. From a brand, it's the right thing to do, so just do it and we'll figure it out. And here we are at this end, and we've learned to be much more flexible about how people can work. So we had to send them all home overnight, and we found miraculously they didn't all stop working. So the learning from that is we've now allowed our staff to decide how many days in the office they want and how many days at home. We've given them all the equipment and facilities to set up a proper home office and to be mobile. So now if somebody's child is sick, they can work from home. If somebody's got the sneezes so they can't come into the office, they don't have to take a day off. If they move overseas, they can stay employed by Partners Life, something we've always wanted to do. Never quite got there, and COVID made us.
So there are opportunities in a crisis.
Absolutely there are, if you find them. And I think the other opportunity is New Zealanders know better now than they ever have before that bad things can happen to health overnight. And that's what these kinds of products are for. So for the customers or consumers that haven't lost their jobs, who are still working and earning an income and are no longer travelling overseas, suddenly things like insurances have become more important. So advisors are busy with customers asking for help rather than them having to go and kind of find somebody, convince them that they need help. So that's been an interesting change as well.
Wonderful. Well, hey, thank you so much, Naomi, for joining us on the Life in the Fast Lane podcast. Some really incredible advice packed in there. I really liked your mentioning of just take a step when you are at that crossroad of deciding what to do, also not letting people's negativity get you down, which is a really important learning, particularly for women too. Just lastly, could you please finish this sentence for me? For your business to survive and thrive, you need?
Passionate people.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Naomi Ballantyne, founder of Cigna and Partners Life. Thank you for listening to Life in the Fast Lane, brought to you by the Deloitte Fast 50, championing New Zealand businesses for the past 20 years.